Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Are you involved in viticulture? Do you actually do part of the farming yourself?
Yeah, a lot. When I started and with the family and we launched the project, most of what I did was on the sales and marketing side and getting everything ready for market. And as times went on, I've probably fallen in love with the vineyard and the cellar practices the most. Just the idea that you grow something all year, you make decisions all year long that get you to an ultimate goal, which is to give the best fruit. I sell to about 25 different people too. We only use maybe 25% of our vineyard, 30% of our vineyard. So as much as I'm my pickiest client, I also have other very picky clients, and wanting to get the most optimal expression out of the fruit for the type of wine that I like to make and all of the clients that pull from a school like to make is really important. So cutting back the irrigation was something that was really important to me. Cutting back fertilization, I cut off herbicides in the last year, really just trying to implore the best practices that we can. And it's the piece of it that I think is probably the most rewarding. You know, you do it for a year long and then you get graded for about 6 weeks every day. It's kind of like taking a test, and then
that's intense.
Everybody, you know, you sell fruit to this guy, he texts you back, he likes it, this is what his chem came in at, you nailed the pick, or whatever it is, and then just getting that validation every day tells you, okay, this is what I need to do at this block. Okay, this didn't come in exactly how I wanted it to. Next year I'm gonna do this at this time instead of that at that time, and make specific small idiosyncratic adjustments that I think in the big picture, it's one of the steps that you take to getting to whatever your end goal is. So not compromising on that is kind of really important to maybe the, it's probably the most important to me of anything. And then as you get into the cellar, if I grow bad fruit, I can't make good sparkling wine. If I grow good fruit, I can still not make good sparkling wine. So I got to do step one to be able to do steps 2 through 30. So it all starts in the vineyard.
Well, this expression is used rather ubiquitously, but you know, it's still as valid as ever. It all starts in the vineyard, and you obviously are very self-aware and hold yourself to a very high standard from what we're hearing. So, you know, guys, that if you actually wind up tasting this wine, and I certainly hope that you do, there's no compromises here. Can you mention some of the people that source fruit from you, just so folks, you know, they may not realize that some of the favorite wineries actually are involved with you?
Yeah, I sell fruit to locally Ian Brand, Russell Joyce. I sell fruit to Folktail. Shied buys some fruit, Landmark buys some fruit, Siduri buys some fruit. There's a bunch of them, and I'm blanking on them.
No, it's okay. You already mentioned some brands that, you know, a lot of people that love wine are familiar with. So it's good to know, because like I didn't know that Siduri and Landmark bought fruit from you, and those are pretty established brands that a lot of people are aware of. So there you go. You mentioned that you started not in the viniculture career at all, even though your family had an agribusiness. So what did you do?
When I went to college, I went to the Bay Area, went to St. Mary's, and kind of got tied up in tech for about a decade from when I went to college until I moved home. So I was in the Bay Area for 10 years, worked for Sun Microsystems in sales, which is kind of how when I came back I started getting into positioning the brand from a sales standpoint, and then fell in love with all of the things that like my roots were actually tied to. So it was very organic in terms of the process of me kind of coming home and then being able to take over something that I fell in love with and getting the opportunity really to learn from Michelle, which was one of the best opportunities of my life, just from him being a ridiculously accredited, talented winemaker, and B, him being a better person. And just getting to know him and how he viewed wine really kind of shaped, I think, you know, where my life is going, where my life has gone in the last years. I didn't anticipate falling in love with everything as much as I have, yeah. I guess, for lack of better terms. I get the romanticism of it in the production and seeing how things age, and more than anything, I probably love the challenge of always wanting to get better, yeah. and the challenge of dancing to the song that's on that you don't have the rhythm for when you get a weird year, and being able to nail the vintage and nail the picks. And it's a hot year. You know, we've had multiple hot years in a row, and then last year was cold. And we were harvesting earlier than ever, and then later than what the normal was. So the paradigm completely shifted. Yeah. Most all of my experience has been in the new normal of California ripening. And then I went back to being behind the old normal, and being able to say, to have that patience and be sure that I harvested at the right time and didn't pull the trigger because I thought the trigger should be pulled because it was the beginning of August.
You know, I find it so fascinating. For the first decade of your professional career, you worked with things that are rather precise, I assume, in technology, and that's what you sold. And if I may ask, why did you move back home? Was it a personal decision?
I thought my family was doing something very distinctive.
Okay, so there was a pull from that direction. You wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And you started in the sales, and wine is, you know, it's so subjective. It's nothing like, you know, technological.
Oh, yeah.
So how was that for you, switching from?
Different, because everybody has an opinion in wine.
Yes, they do.
And it's coming into it from that standpoint. Sometimes you want to apply opinion as fact, and it's not generally true. It's mostly just opinion.
Yeah.
And kind of your truth is your truth. And if you don't like my sparkling wine because your palate doesn't like my sparkling wine, I'm never going to convince you to like it. Mm-hmm. That's not the point. But if you have a server that you need for your data infrastructure to back up these types of things and you're not doing it, you actually need that. Whether yeah. you don't buy it from Sun or you buy it from IBM or whoever, you need that. There's a need. You don't need to drink sparkling wine. You don't need to drink champagne. You can have a vodka tonic or whatever at the bar if you would rather do it. There's a lot of substitute goods. So to me, kind of coming to that and understanding the romantic side of what we do and why it's romantic, I guess, I hate that term, but from the straight linear position of sales, it's about the opposite of a skew. Mm-hmm. Where it's your baby, it's something yeah. you love, it's something that you've spent years with. And I can only think of when I released the Blanc de Blanc from 16 that my son loaded the press of, like, that'll mean a lot to me, getting that wine to that point and then releasing it and it being the first Blanc de Blanc and something that has ties to my son and ties to Michelle. That visceral connection, I guess, is different.
Yeah, it has to be. And you spoke so beautifully about how you fell in love. And, you know, given your background, which I'm sure actually was really helpful in the business side of it, because wine is a business, but the romance part of it, there had to have been such powerful connection, whether it was that fateful meeting of your family and Michelle, or you just starting to practice viticulture and cellar work, but somewhere along the way there was such a compelling pull for you personally that you're all in.
Yep. It's really how it happened. It was very organic. It was very, I loved the brand, I loved the product, and then I should learn more about all of the idiosyncratic things, and then you end up doing them.
Well, but that's part of the process, and I hear from a lot of producers that the craft is very humbling. It keeps you very grounded because you're subject to Mother Nature and you can't argue with that. You can only work with her as much as you can. And that has to be in and out of itself, a whole different way of, you know, approaching it and living it every day.
Yeah, which is maybe the hardest part for me because I'm kind of a control freak. So relinquishing control to Mother Nature is always, I guess that's the one thing that I have to give control to, but that's what makes it fun, right? Is the variable. And what could make it a great vintage?
Yeah.
What could make it exceptional?
Yes.
How do you make sure it's not mediocre? If you have a bad vintage, I won't produce anything. It's the same thing we did in 11. I didn't make any sparkling wine. And if knowing that when it gets to that point, it's not there, or the Chardonnay from 2018 didn't have enough acid on its own, so I didn't make a Blanc de Blanc, but instead made more Blanc de Noir because the acid in the Blanc de Noir in Pinot was more prevalent than in most years.
Yeah.
And just being able to not be so rigid, but be rigid enough.
Well, clearly this business keeps you on your toes in many ways. And from what I've gotten to know this morning, it don't shy away from a challenge. So many more exciting things ahead. Speaking of exciting things, we have wine in the glass that I've been lovingly and longingly staring at while we're talking. What are we having?
So this is our 2013 Brut Cuvée. We released this a few months ago, so it's relatively young in its life. Mm-hmm. It's 60% Chardonnay, 40% Pinot Noir. 4 years lees aging, and it's about a year on the cork before we release. We're firm believers in cork aging as well as lees aging and them working together symbiotically, as opposed to I don't think you can just leave something on the lees for 10 years and then it's automatically really leesy.
Oh my god, I just took a sip. That is extraordinary. There's so many flavors going on. I think the laundry list would read like a scroll. Beautiful aromatics, of course, but the texture of that wine is really remarkable. The mouthfeel.
Thank you. I think Michelle's mousse and the process that allows us to go through secondary the way that we do it really speaks to kind of that textural feel that you get where it coats your tongue, mm-hmm. then goes down the side of your tongue. You get the mm-hmm. acid pitch, but you mm-hmm. get the fruit expression, and then you want to go back to the glass, and that's really a nod to Michelle.
Well, this is quite an execution. He'd be very proud. I have not had any wine from this area that resembles anything like it, so I'm very pleased. Do you hold any wines back? Do you have a library?
Yeah, and thank you. I have a pretty decent library. We do probably like 10% of our production in magnums too.
Wow, that's really fun.
So I hold a lot of magnums back just because they age so well and they age so slowly.
Yeah.
But I try to keep about 20 cases of every vintage in library. And then I'm holding back more as time goes on, and I know how things age. So 2009 mm-hmm. was very much a Chardonnay-focused year for us, mm-hmm. where we had a lot of the bright citrus expression, some of the tropical notes, some of that really pitchy acidity in mm-hmm. the early life of it. So I kept a whole pallet back with 86 packs, and then we just re-released that recently, and it's way more leesy now, a lot more of that like autolytic expression throughout the profile with still that bright citrus, but just kind of seeing where it went really when it's 10 years old was really interesting to me. But knowing that when it was getting to the point of selling out and saving that last pallet because I was so excited about where it was going, I've continued to sell her more things, like as it happens. And I think they have potential.
Well, economically speaking, I'm sure your accountants are not happy with that, with that program, but for consumer, it's a paradise. They get to taste aged wines that I sell it properly, so the best manner possible. And then they get to taste it in this optimum as you see fit as a winemaker. And obviously it's gonna continue to improve in the cellar, but you are catching it the moment that you feel it's showing so well. And
yeah.
then releasing it. I just think that's a huge value added. So again, listeners, take note. There's not that many instances, not enough for me, when you can buy library releases from wineries, because again, it's not a very easy thing to swallow as a business to hold inventory back like that.
Yeah, it's not. The accountants don't love it, but I guess the piece that makes it work is once you've gotten to this position of patience, it's easier for me to continue to be patient than for me to set the standard of patience. So the fact that we waited so long to release everything and everything was really built with that in mind made it easy to hold a pallet back longer or this many six packs back longer. If you came into the tasting room today, you'd be able to taste 13 Brut, 13 Rosé, 09 Brut, and you could taste 09 Natur. So you could taste the 09s with and without dosage, and then what is current vintage. So there's a projection of how this wine could age. Similarly, they're not, 09 was more Chardonnay focused, but they're not drastically different, just to show people, hey, this is kind of where it's going. And if you like where it's at now, you can enjoy it right now. If the 09 is, you know, there. And you mentioned earlier about like some of the, I guess, misconceptions or things that people lack understanding about when it comes to sparkling wine, and being able to show the same exact wine with and without dosage is one of those tools that we like to kind of do here, just from an explanation standpoint of explaining the process is one thing, but tasting them both is something else.
Absolutely.
And then you get to see what happens as this ages and as that ages and how it cohesively comes together or stays really linear, which is tends to be the way no dosage works. It's more of a straight line, and you kind of got to hit it in its optimal position of consumption.
So dosage sounds like a balancing act to me, more so than what people typically associate with your stating. Sometimes people think it's all about the sugar, and it's not.
Yeah, dosage is probably the one thing sparkling winemakers have that can actually make things better. It's your tool to balance at the very end. So depending on how much acid you have and how much of that acid is malic, potentially. Malic acid generally tastes very green apple-ish and can be more sour on the palate. And because I don't put things through malolactic fermentation, that's something that in when we apply dosage, I have to be very cognizant of in terms of levels of dosage. So I balance it to this is where I want it to go, as opposed to the yin and the yang.
Yeah. Very cool. So what are we tasting next? And while you are pouring, I am going to pick your brain on large formats, because I happen to be a big fan of large format wines, but there's quite a variety of opinions as to why larger formats sell it better. You mentioned they sell it slower.
Yep.
So let's talk about that.
Michelle was so crazy, he wanted to put everything in Magnums. I think because he wasn't going to sell any of it.
I love that sound. That's like my second favorite sound. The first one is pouring. So he was that big of a believer.
Yeah. And the real reason of it is the fact that you have twice the volume. The neck on a Magnum is the same size as the neck on a 750. Use the same cork.
Got it.
So the amount of cuvée that is exposed to oxygen is double the volume for the same amount of oxygen. That's why it ages so much slower. So it gives you that opportunity to really kind of, if you have a bell curve of optimal consumption, grab it on its tails and stretch it, and then amplify the middle higher than it even was with the 750. Because I think Magnums reach probably the best expression of your cuvée if you ferment in that bottle.
Wow.
If you do secondary. Like, I can taste 750s next to Magnums all the time. It'll be subtle.
Yeah.
But and it gets more drastic as more time goes on. Just because that interaction that happens with the oxygen as well with the cuvée over time, it will oxidize more. But in the 750, but the complexity, the softness, the integration with acid and the fruit is pretty remarkable in a Magnum. I think a Magnum is the best vessel to age sparkling wine through secondary fermentation.
How about that? Does that trajectory continue for double magnums and so on and so forth, or is that a sweet spot?
Michelle didn't believe so, so I don't either.
Okay, got it.
But he was a firm believer that magnums were the stopping point. You start at 750s, you stop at magnums. You don't put anything in a 375, and you only put something bigger than a magnum if you want to be a spectacle.
Ah, so there's no value added to a large format.
Yeah, it doesn't ferment as well through secondary in a bigger format.
Got it.
And in a small format, you don't have the lees aging, which is why I think some of the best 375 sparkling wines, champagnes across the world were actually fermented in magnums and then transfused to 375s.
Wow.
Just because you have a more homogeneous expression. Everything integrates better. It's less jagged, less austere, and at 19 bricks and 10 TA, things kind of want to be that way, unless you really are diligent about making sure you go through all the steps so they're not.
Wow, so I'm so glad that you're bottling magnums, because it's not as common of a format for champagne and sparkling wines. And let's face it, who wants to drink beautiful wine by themselves, right? We always want to share. So magnum lends itself so much more naturally to that. You won't run out of wine so quickly.
Michelle always quoted Churchill, but a magnum's perfect for two if one is not drinking.
I love it. I'm surprised that quote is not
everywhere
here somewhere on the wall. Yes, I love it.
Yeah, it's... I love magnums. I think it's... When we go to most events, when I pour at most places, I like to share magnums. I think it's a great way of kind of the communal sharing of the bottles, and the overall expression you get, I feel, is heightened. So whenever I do events or I'm going or doing a dinner, I try to kind of bring in tow magnums if I know we're going to be opening that much sparkling wine. Saves me a little bit of time on opening, but also I think it's always great. A lot of people don't get to drink magnums a lot, So it's really fun to share that expression with people.
Who doesn't want a magnum of sunshine?
There you go. I like it. That should also go on the wall.
Exactly. This smells so good. Entirely different, of course. I love the floral components in addition to the fruit.
A little bit more of that Pinot Noir florality. Some of those terroir notes show through. I always feel like our Brut showcases more Chardonnay expression. And then you have under that the Lizzy expression. And then the Pinot kind of lives in tertiary. Where when you get to the Brut Rosé, Pinot takes the forefront.
Yep.
And then it goes to citrus secondary and kind of lazy integration on the tertiary third kind of flavor component. Mm-hmm. So it ends up having those things that people love about Pinot without it being super hit you in the head.
Yeah.
And just a fruit bomb. We don't want that. As they age, they go more umami.
Yes. Gorgeous acidity. Teeny tiny bubbles. Just looking at it, I could just stare at it. Sorry, you guys. I'm just going to take a moment. No, it's so beautiful. And again, that texture. Oh, my goodness. You know, this is such a personality in the glass. You could have a cold conversation just sitting here and sipping and smelling and tasting. And there's just so much palatal presence. Again, that unctuous, very assertive character.
Thank you. I'm really proud of both of these wines, and it's maybe more crazy to me that they're only 1% different.
Yes, I would have never guessed that in a million years. And that's the beauty of tasting it side by side. And can we just talk about a finish for a moment? Long finish.
Yeah, it goes. The structure that we have, and you put it on lees that long, it'll allow you to go to pasta and come back to it and still be there.
I totally believe that. I think if Parker was writing a note, this would be like 45 second, a minute. You know, it's just, it keeps going and going and going. And I don't know about you guys, but to me, that's a big deal. A wine should be a story. It should have the beginning, middle, and an end. And the end is the finish.
Yep.
And, you know, when it lingers like that, that means a lot.
And if the end sucks, you don't want to read the book again.
Exactly. And you don't want a sequel, do you?
Yeah.
So we're going to taste something else as well. I understand that we have a couple more options. And meanwhile, I'll pick your brain. And what is it that you are drinking yourself? What's in your cellar besides your own wine?
I drink a decent amount of Rhone. Yeah. I grafted 2.5 acres to Syrah last April. I drink a decent amount of champagne just from a position of always trying to keep myself educated on what else is going on out there, what other producers are doing, what this expression or this vintage was like. Mm-hmm. And then I probably drink more Syrah in the last year than anything.
We have a pretty diverse palate, meaning that you don't just drink New World wines, or do you lean in any sort of...
I probably drink more Old World wines.
Yeah.
Then I drink New World wines a lot too. Okay. I get exposed to a lot of really cool stuff. Just our broker in California is Revel, so they have all the
That's
cool kids stuff.
Slope. Oh yeah. My god.
So I get to taste all the really cool stuff often, and that's a great weather vane for me.
Yeah.
And then you go to kind of the tradition.
Yeah.
In Old World, and kind of where a lot of our process is rooted in. Mm-hmm. And I get to see the expressions of sunshine through varying different processes, so to speak, and get to see how I see other people's wines progressing, how I see them progressing in terms of our wine and aging and those types of things. Because I bottle age our still wine a little bit more, mm-hmm. it's always interesting to taste, you know, Burgundy Chardonnays in this vintage compared to New World Chardonnays in this vintage compared to ours, and see where it really stands. A lot of people, when they walk through the tasting room or when I'm in a state selling wine, they always have a position of, I like this, I like this. They like it. Wine's always likening things.
Yeah.
It's this tastes like this. This, you know, it's so common. So then it's, I always try to come back to it and build an understanding from a palate perspective myself, mm-hmm. if I can, and see if I can find truth in something that sometimes people say. I just got back from Illinois recently, and I was working the market in Chicago, and a couple people said things to me that were really interesting, and I came home and purchased those bottles and then did a lineup with myself blind and a few other friends so I could see if I noticed some of the same pulls that they were making in comparison.
Yeah.
Just trying to understand why.
Yeah.
Why it lived on their palate the same way.
Yeah.
And it's usually when somebody says something to me that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
That it's like really intriguing to go and like figure it out. And there have been quite a few times that I've been able to not expect or not understand that a certain wine would exhibit or express itself a certain way from mm-hmm. a certain place. Mm-hmm. And then somebody gives me a marker.
Yeah.
And then you go revisit it and it holds true.
Yeah.
And that it kind of is like a little bit very mind-blowing in your head of like, oh wow, I did not know that could do that from there. I didn't realize that varietal was as flexible from that place, or, you know, a lot of those types of understandings.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you just gave a really important pointer to the listener. You said finding the truth. Of course, the expression that gets used without necessarily pausing to think what it means is in vino veritas.
Yes.
Wine is truth, but not in every wine there's truth. And you find your truth through tasting. And I wanted to see what your take was on giving the consumer advice on finding their truth in wine, because it's a big, confusing, incredibly saturated world.
So I guess when you say that, the thing that comes to my mind is every time I go to dinner with my friends and they just hand me the menu and tell me to order.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do I order something knowing this group of friends that they're going to enjoy, and not me just going and ordering what I want? And a lot of it is trying not to be so much of a wine dork and technologically focused that you lose sight of the experience.
Yeah.
And just like talking to my friends or talking to consumers about like, what do you actually like in wine? Mm-hmm. What's the experience that you like? What's give somebody a wine that's a marker and what's wrong with this. And a lot of times people have understandings about wine that aren't necessarily true. This wine is sweet. Well, it's actually bone dry, but has a lot of oak on it. So what people identify with from a flavor standpoint and what's actually going on in the wine's chemistry or the wine's production style, and how do I take the tidbit of information that somebody shares with you and then give them the best recommendation on how, what that means from process.
Yeah.
My mother's kind of a Chardonnay snob, mm-hmm. and picking Chardonnay for her is about the most difficult thing that I can do. And from probably like the last 10 years since we've been doing this, I should probably have a spreadsheet of all of the wines that she's liked and not liked, because it would maybe make my understanding more easier. But it's like, she just knowing at this point now, I can have an idea of places she likes wine from, places she likes Chardonnay from, places she doesn't like Chardonnay from, mm-hmm. processes that she likes, processes that she doesn't like. And then you look at a menu and it kind of like drills down. And it's like, no for these reasons to these wines, yes to these. Okay, yeah, these are going to be the ones that are going to exhibit the most enjoyment. Yeah. And that's all wine is. You got to like it.
Yeah, so I'm hearing be wine curious, be inquisitive.
Yep.
And taste.
Yes,
and
taste.
Figure it out for yourself.
And don't just drink the same things.
Yeah.
Don't order the same bottle.
Yeah.
If you're at a restaurant and you drank one bottle and it was great, order something else. Ask the psalm, what else, if I liked this, what else should I drink?
Yeah.
Because just drinking another bottle of the same thing isn't going to do anything for you.
Excellent. Great, great sentiments. We are tasting the 2016 Chardonnay, and you said you like to age them a little bit. So
yep.
This has been bottle aged for, what, a year or two?
Yeah, about two.
Two.
Prior to release.
Okay. Again, I took a sip while we were talking. I'm starting to sound like a broken record, but that texture, that mid palate, that storyline, you know, the middle part, the
yep.
most interesting part in a lot of books, that's so happening. The theme is, runs through your sparkling and your still wines.
Thank you. I have to follow the same line as our sparkling wine in terms of our still wine.
Mm-hmm.
In the experience and what they should give consumers, what they should allow people to enjoy about our wine. And being light-handed in our Chardonnay process was something that was really important to us. Nothing goes through malolactic fermentation, because none of the bubbles go through malolactic fermentation.
Right.
Then I can't use the barrels for Chardonnay for the barrels for sparkling wine.
Mm-hmm.
So really kind of like those processes that were set up, and then knowing that my vineyard has a lot of acid, and the position of balancing that acid in the Chardonnay was, in this vintage, 30% of it was 24 hours of skin contact on Clone 76, which really kind of fleshed out that mid palate that you're talking about, integrated the acidity, so
yeah.
It's not so linearly structural to the point that you get fruit, you get texture, you get richness, and then you get the acid that kind of brings that finish in and carries it all through, so you
Absolutely.
Get to that next sip.
No, you describe it so well. I don't need to say anything. I just want to highlight the acidity piece of it. It is so bright and prominent, and yet it's so well integrated that you're not noticing it. It's not pitchy. I love that word that you used earlier, at all. It's just this beautiful song.
Thank you.
I really don't want to move on. I'm forcing myself, but there's one more wine to taste, and
yep.
that's your red wine, right?
Yep, and we will taste our 2016 Pinot Noir. So same vintage as Chardonnay. We release our Pinot and our Chardonnay together mm-hmm. because the Chardonnay has more acid in general, and it takes a little bit more bottle aging mm-hmm. for it to get to that position of balance. Mm-hmm. So 16 is current vintage for both of our Pinot and our Chard. Light-handed winemaking, similar to the rest of the wines, 10 months French oak, 20% new, really 13.5 alcohol, so pulled right at 23 and change.
Mm.
Really wanting to not have the glycerol in the wine, in the alcohol, take dominance over some of the secondary and tertiary characteristics that I think make the Highlands so great. Some of that bay laurel, the sage, the things that when you're spice. Standing on the hillside and the wind is blowing in your face on a dry day in the middle of summer. And to me, some of that should come through in the wine. It shouldn't just be red fruit, and not wanting to homogenize it to the point that that goes away, and instead just make it really clean, not a lot of oak, but get it to a point that all of those characteristics within the wine live in their own pocket of kind of the palate experience of that wine.
So you guys, jewel tones, it's so pretty to look at. I know there's varied opinions in the wine world whether color matters, what matters to me. I'm a visual person, I'm looking at it, I can't stop staring. Sexy as hell.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm blown away here. This is my first time trying the wines, which I'm slightly embarrassed to admit, because I shouldn't have missed them. They're both significant and extremely pleasurable.
I really appreciate that.
What's in store for the future for your brand?
Getting better every year. And to me, that's the most important thing. Not sitting on our laurels, not treading water. Every vintage, we come out of it with two or three things that I want to do in the vineyard for each wine to make that wine better. Two or three things that I want to do in the cellar to make that wine better. And we do trials all of the time. I'll do small lots. I'll see how that actually makes my wine better, doesn't make my wine better. Some of them get ditched after 1 year. Sometimes they go right into the wine after 1 year, like the skin contact on the 16 Chardonnay. It was the first time we ever tried it. Mm-hmm. And it was like, wow, this really adds something to this wine that to me is reminiscent of walking the row, throwing the Chardonnay grape in your mouth and chewing it and letting like the skin dissipate. And you get that textural flavor build that does the same thing. So primarily making the wines that we make the best way that we can, continuing to improve as we go estate. Secondarily, continuing to find pockets of grapes on our vineyard that express themselves uniquely enough to potentially be their own bottling. I harvested in 2016 was the first time I ever pulled clone 943 of Pinot Noir, which is a very small cluster, small berry clone. Mm-hmm. And it ended up becoming its own wine.
Wow, how exciting.
So it ended up being its own still Pinot Noir, 100 cases of it. I never anticipated that was the case, but mm-hmm. when we got it into the cellar, it was like, wow, this is remarkably unique and very distinctive in terms of expression. Do I just put it in my main blend and do the easy answer and say I made my main blend easier, or do I come up with another package and bottle these four barrels as themselves? Mm-hmm. And I kind of went with, okay, we've made still wine from 2007 to 2015 with only making one Chardonnay and one Pinot. And that was the first time I ever decided to make another wine, which was another Pinot. So really that is kind of the next step, is seeing as the vineyard matures, we're an 11th leaf now, as I've been able to restrict irrigation on the vineyard, clonal expression is heightening, and I'm able to assemble things earlier. Mm-hmm. Ideally, I want to assemble them only almost in the vineyard. In addition with the wine I was just talking about, which we call El Bec after my great uncle, mm-hmm. I have another bottling where I literally take the top 14 rows that are multiple different clones, different root stocks, and they grow together. I harvest them together. They ferment together. They get bottled together. They literally live their whole lives, these 14 rows, as one. And I didn't really know that until 2017, which was the first time I made that wine. Up until then, we harvested the clones that are in those 14 rows with the other blocks that coincided with the clones.
Yeah.
And I never got anything extra out of it in the cellar. Me and the winemaking team were, okay, let's try something different. Let's mm-hmm. harvest it all together. And it came out very much more like a lullaberry pie, mm-hmm. where like this is red fruit lifted. It kind of has more blue and black fruit under it. And it was just its own, really its own expression out of the vineyard living in its own place. Mm-hmm. So honing everything in, trying always to get better. And if there is another wine that I can make that is true to our beliefs and I'm not making a wine to make a wine, that's what I'll do. I'm not going to make a wine to sell to the wine club. I'm not going to make a wine because I set out to make this specific thing. That's not me. I grafted to 2.5 acres of Syrah because I believe cold climate Syrah is awesome. And in Northern SLH, I believe I can grow some really great Syrah. So it started around, okay, how can we, what clones do I use? So you drink a bunch of domestic Syrah because you can't just drink Rhone. That's not fair. And figure out what producers I liked in cold climate, what clones were they using, and kind of go full circle in terms of what were the two clones that I grafted. And seeing where that wine is in Y1 and where it'll be in Y5, it'll be interesting kind of as we progress and we keep making it, but I'm confident we can make a very feminine, pretty Syrah that isn't, I don't want something like similar to the rest of our wines. I'm not going to make something that's hugely broad-shouldered and overblown. It just doesn't fit the portfolio of what we're doing. And starting with the sparkling, to me, it's got to be a progression, much like a meal. If you start at Brut and you end at Syrah, it should be bigger than Pinot, but it shouldn't be not within your scope of what we're doing. And this types of wines that we make, I think wanting to ride that line of restraint is really important to me and our family.
It sounds like a very dynamic, bright future that's extremely conscious of what matters and great value, foundationally speaking, when you mentioned that you will never make a wine just to make a wine. I hope you guys heard that loud and clear, because not every brand has that mentality, and the brands that do are very worthwhile, very worth honoring. So if you hadn't heard enough incentive to taste Caraccioli wines, I don't know what would do it. I certainly have, and if you need additional, I'm looking at the plaques on the wall of all kinds of awards and best of class, and you can research for yourself. We haven't talked about that, but this is a very awarded winery. It's very recognized in both trade and consumer community. And I want to emphasize trade because they're the hardest to please. But there's a lot of very prominent restaurants and bottle shops, very carefully selected, that carry the wine. And the wine is highly allocated. So what's the best place for folks to go after it?
If you want to drink a bottle at home, the best place is probably to call the tasting room, just because I can ship to most all states. Mm-hmm. And I'm not in a lot of bottle shops because I don't have enough wine. So most of our distribution ends up being in restaurants. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of places you can enjoy the wine at a restaurant. And there are bottle shops in every city. And most of the big cities, there's one or two that might carry it. But if you go to caraccioliSellers.com, you can ship anything out to you. You can call the tasting room, 831-622-7722. Any of the staff will be happy to get bottles out to you. And that's the best way that you'll be able to have everything like that we offer. If you wanted a Pinot and a Brut, or to try all of the wines, really kind of touching us directly is the best place that has everything. If you're in San Francisco, K&L has all of the wines. There's a handful of places throughout the country, throughout the state that do.
There you go. You have a plan of action now. And with that, I thank you very much for hosting me and pouring me this beautiful creatures that I am immensely impressed by. And I will follow your brand very closely. I cannot wait to taste your future offerings.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.